repatriate whatever we recover," Taw said distantly. He jutted his chin toward the Pelear technician at the transporter controls. "Send them back."
"No!"
As the word formed, Burnham felt the humming in her ears, and emerald light washed over her. The metallic mesh panels enclosing the elevator platform drew back, and Britch Wheaton was shoved unceremoniously onto the command deck of the Pelear Starfreighter. He tried to look in every direction at once. This was his first ever hostage situation, and he wasn't sure of how things were supposed to play out. Starfleet's broad guidelines on this kind of thing took the position that negotiating was the first and best way to defuse a dangerous situation. Anything that prevented loss of life was to be considered, and a violent response was warranted only under the most serious of conditions. But it was one thing for an instructor in Wheaton's Academy class on comparative ethics to talk about those things in a calm and rational manner, and quite another to be in the thick of it, with angry four-armed aliens pointing guns in your face and snarling at you in a language your UT can barely process. When they pulled him out of the mess hall, his first thought was that they were going to make an example of him. Lieutenant Saru had been gone for hours, and just before the Gorlands had come for Wheaton, they'd taken away a bunch of the Pelears as well. Are they flushing people out of the airlock one at a time? He'd heard scuttlebutt about Nausicaan pirates doing that to their victims, and his skin crawled with the grim possibility. But they went right past the docking ring and headed up to the command level. Wheaton and the others had felt the change when the big ship had dropped out of warp, and for a while he had dared to hope that meant his ordeal was nearing its end. For all Nurse Zoxum's hard work, Lieutenant Commander Johar was still unconscious, and Wheaton feared that the chief engineer would never awaken if they couldn't get him to a proper medical facility. Watching Johar's face turn the color of tilled earth and his breath come in gasps made Wheaton's hands clench. He hated not being able to do something to help. Now he was here, and there were lights and screaming sirens, and he had no idea what the hell was going on. "Ensign!" He spun toward the sound of the voice, and there was Saru, gesticulating wildly with those big, long Kelpian arms of his, frantically beckoning him toward one of the consoles. "Get over here!"
"Sir?"
As he approached, he saw a Gorland female working another panel and the Pelear engineer Raiden at a control rig. Raiden very clearly didn't want to be doing whatever it was he was doing.
"This ship is counting down to an ejection sequence that will detach all of the cargo pods," snapped Saru, waving his hand at a screen that showed a graphic of the transport vessel and the container modules attached to its spinal hull frame. "We have to stop it now."
"Drop sequence will start at the stern."
Standing close by, the Pelear second officer Hekan studied the same screen.
"It's all automated. Once started, it can't be stopped."
"For the Creator's sake, pray you are mistaken,"
growled the Gorland female, and she looked to Saru.
"We are moving everyone forward, but it may not be enough."
"I can understand what the Gorlands are saying," said Wheaton, his mind racing as he tried to take everything in. "I mean, better than before. How is that?"
"Not relevant," Saru said sharply. "You're here because I told them to bring you. Get on that console and block the activation sequences on the release mechanisms."
"Okay."
Wheaton went to the panel and immediately saw the problem. The automated controls had multiple redundancies that meant no single operator could override them alone. To force the module ejection sequence into a null mode needed at least four pairs of hands. "Lucky we have a Gorlan here," he thought. Wheaton brought up the main control and made an attempt to put the command system into a feedback loop, but it bifurcated the order string to the other consoles and worked around him.
"Oh, this is a tricky one."
"Try to put the release gears into a maintenance mode," said the Gorlan woman. "It won't stop the drop sequence, but it will delay it."
"Why is this happening?"
Wheaton asked the question out loud, but then he pushed it aside.
Those pods are full of people. We have to keep them alive.
That was all that was important for now. The young engineer put out of his mind all thought of the armed, angry Gorlans crowding around him. He didn't dwell on whose lives he was being asked to save. He set to the task just as he had been trained to.
"I can't stop it!" cried the Gorlan. "Oh, Creator, grant mercy!"
Wheaton looked up as the rearmost cargo module on the display changed to a blinking blue-white. On an inset screen, he saw huge hatches dropping closed to seal the container off from the rest of the vessel. Tiny figures scrambled to get through to the far side before the gap closed. Dozens of terrified Gorlans clawed at the deck as they tried desperately to escape. Then the timbre of the warning siren changed, and the screen went blank. Wheaton heard a distant thudding of magnetic bolts and couldn't stop himself from stealing a glance out of the main viewport. A dark, slab-sided shape was drifting away from the star freighter's stern, trailing crystals of frozen atmosphere.
Did they all get out in time?
Unclear, said Saru grimly. On Wheaton's panel, he saw the same process repeating itself in the next module as the mechanisms of a second container prepared to detach. He made a decision and switched off the visual feed showing the chaos and panic unfolding at the hatches.
I can't look. Can't lose myself in that. What would Johara say? Do the work, Britch, he told himself, repeating it like a mantra. Do the work.
He looked back at the failed loop program and frowned.
Okay, wait. I think I see what I did wrong.
Wheaton looked to Saru.
Can we both try this together? Two inputs at the same time might slow the function cycle.
He glanced at Raiden and the Gorlan woman. At the same time, if you try the maintenance mode thing.
That might work.
Saru saw the way Wheaton was thinking.
Kijo, can you do it?
I will try, said the Gorlan woman, and she gave Raiden a pointed look.
The Pelear engineer glanced at Hekan, seeking her permission. She gave it, and he made an affirmative gesture.
Do it now,
Saru ordered, and Wheaton committed the program once again. It was awkward working on the unfamiliar Pelear console with their splayed-out keypad setup and curved screens, but he got around it.
Done!
He shouted, his heart pounding in his chest.
Done! Echoed Saru.
Raiden and Kijo both did their part, and there was a moment where no one moved or spoke. Then, a new and more strident alarm began to bray, loud enough that it gave Wheaton a start.
What? No! Did we screw it up?
He looked back through the viewport, afraid that he would see more modules coming adrift, more debris clouding the space around the big ship. But then Kijo gave him a double slap on the back that almost knocked him over.
The alarm is the shutdown warning! We stopped it!
For now, muttered Raiden, stepping back from his console. He gave Hekan a poisonous glare and let himself be led back to where his commander was watching from across the compartment.
I'm missing something, said Wheaton. Little help, Lieutenant?
We have just saved thousands of lives, Saru told him.
The Kelpian looked washed out and fatigued. That is all that matters. That wasn't in doubt, but there was more going on here, and the ensign wasn't about to be brushed off.
So we're working with them now?
He nodded toward the Gorlan hijackers.
It's complicated, sighed the lieutenant.
Yeah, no kidding, Wheaton replied.
You failed again, shouted a hard, angry voice.
The Gorlan with the white hair strode forward and menaced the captive Pelears.
You have underestimated us, denigrated us from the start, but we endured!
He looks really pissed off,
the ensign said quietly.
You have no idea, Saru offered.
No more lies, hissed the Gorlan leader. Pelear Zell will be called to account.
The red band reached for the disruptor holstered on his crossbelt, and Saru saw it too.
Mado, stop!
The Kelpian rose up and waved his hands, and he looked to Wheaton like a scarecrow trying to hold back a thunderstorm.
What good does it do to take out your frustration on them?
Perhaps you are a better target.
The alien called Mado cast a threatening glare in Saru and Wheaton's direction.
Those cargo modules down on the planet's surface.
Saru gestured at the gloomy ball of cinders they were orbiting, and Wheaton started to piece things together. Suddenly the automated drop sequence made sense. This wasn't the first time this had happened.
Your people are alive, surviving, the lieutenant was saying. We can find a way to communicate with them, and those modules are still intact and whole. It might even be possible to bring them back up into orbit.
Evacuate them?
Kijo came closer, running a single hand over her sweating brow.
Yes, it might work. If I can remote program the thrusters on the modules, tie in to the freighter's tractor beam arrays.
You see?
Saru was animated by the possibility.
Aggression wins you nothing.
The lieutenant looked toward the ensign for support, but all Wheaton could do was give him a wooden nod.
Will you do anything to prevent bloodshed?
Mado said coldly, and Saru didn't seem to pick up on the menacing subtext in his words.
The Shenzhou will come looking for its people.
For us, Saru went on. And when they do, I will speak for you. I will put your case to my captain and the Federation. There will be an appeal. Rough, harsh laughter rolled around the command deck, and the lieutenant fell silent. Wheaton had been in rooms with hard-faced, hate-filled people like this before, in darker times of his life, and despite the fact he was on the bridge of an alien starship light-years from home, it felt horribly familiar.
I don't think he's interested in that, sir.
I am tired of promises,
Mado said slowly, weighing every word.
I have heard too many of them. They are all made of dust.
He crossed the chamber toward the Starfleet officers.
Our patience is at an end.
The Gorlan leaned in, and he fixed Saru with a pitiless gaze.
Yes, your ship will come for you.
What he said next made Wheaton's blood run cold.
I am counting on it.
The carrier passed beyond the edge of our sensor range 3 minutes ago, said Chithalo as he entered Captain Georgiou's ready room. The drones they left behind are crowding us.
He made a dismissive gesture toward the window on the aft bulkhead. Burnham leaned forward and looked out through the portal. She could see one of the automated escort craft cruising uncomfortably close to the Shenzhou off the ship's stern. There was a weapons turret protruding from the prow of the vessel, and the muzzles of the high-energy phase cannons mounted there were tracking them.
Admiral Taw left us with an ultimatum, added the first officer. If we don't start moving back toward the border within the hour, the escorts will open fire on us. We try to raise shields, they open fire. We power up our weapons.
I get the picture. Can we neutralize them?
Georgiou sat on the edge of her desk as she struggled out of the tactical vest over her duty uniform. The Andorian's expression soured.
Yes, but not without taking some hits ourselves. Phasers are still not up to optimal status.
He paused.
Our engineering team is good. But they're not...
Not Saladin Johar or Britch Wheaton?
No, she agreed.
Next time, Number One, remind me not to send our two best engineers off on any landing parties at the same time.
She paused, thinking.
What about our warp drive? Are they done building that replacement access control?
Chithalo's grim expression hardened.
There's been an issue with the fabricator. The first replacement didn't meet spec. It's a very delicate piece of equipment. It has to be flawless.
We have warp engines in our shuttlecraft,
They use Axis control units, said Burnham, breaking her silence. Can't we pull the same component from the Fae or Liu? Modify it somehow?
That was the first thing we tried, he told her. They burned out immediately. Something about comparative mass versus size of the warp shell. We'd need a unit from a vessel with a larger tonnage to have any chance of making it work.
Burnham's eyebrow rose. How much larger, sir?
I know that look, said Giorgio.
If you have a suggestion, Lieutenant, let's hear it.
Chitalo folded his arms.
At this point, we're open to all counsel.
She raised her hand and pointed out of the window, toward the escort drone. With the situation on the command deck stable, the red bands crowded around Saru and Wheaton, and under Maddo's orders they were again led down through the lower decks, this time into a section of the ship they had not visited before. Here, the transport's artificial gravity was set to replicate a zero-G environment, and the hatchway opened to allow access to a spherical chamber crisscrossed by metal bars studded with handholds. The Gorlands, with their additional limbs, moved through the space with speed and ease, pushing themselves off the walls and slipping from grip to grip. The Kelpian and the Terran were forced to take things slower, floating in toward the construct in the middle of the space. Computer core? Suggested Wheaton, taking in the thick trunks of data cables that emerged from the walls to converge with the tetrahedral unit. Saru nodded, watching the to-and-fro pulses of white light moving along the lines. The compartment had the same shabby, hard-working air as the rest of the vessel, but it was a functional space. "Why have you brought us here?" he asked, searching for Maddo.
"This ship is still fighting us," said the Gorlan. "The control software in its systems must be completely purged. Then, and only then, will we be sure that the Pleiars can no longer affect it?"
"And you'll release them? And us?" Saru pressed.
"When this is done," Maddo continued, "we will do as you said. Bring our people up from where they were abandoned. Kijo says the additional cargo modules can be docked to this ship's exterior."
He made a coming-together motion with his hands, then looked back at them.
"Can you delete the programs working against us or not?"
"It is possible," admitted Saru, "but the Pleiars would be better equipped to do it."
"They won't help us anymore."
Maddo dismissed the suggestion.
"But you, Saru, you'll help me again, won't you?"
"Again?" Wheaton shot him a questioning look.
"Lieutenant, what is he talking about?"
Saru's threat ganglia squirmed, and the skin across the Kelpian's face tightened into a grimace as he fought the reaction.
"I will help you recover those people on the surface, if that is what it takes to save lives."
"It will," said Maddo, "starting with those of your people and the Pleiars."
The weight of the endless circular argument came pressing down on Saru once again.
"You do not need to threaten me," he said.
"That is untrue," Maddo shot back. "We need to prove our resolve. The Tholians and the Pleiars taught us a lesson. If all you do is run, then you are nothing more than prey."
He showed a mouthful of teeth.
"I see something in you, Saru. I think you know better than anyone on this ship what it is to be that. On some level, you understand."
And the terrible truth was, he did. Saru had lived a life under threat from predators, and a part of him would always resent those creatures.
"There is no prey that does not dream of becoming the hunter."
He could feel Maddo's powerful aura field, the invisible crackle of the Gorlan's barely chained anger and his rebellious will.
"Do not keep pushing," Saru managed, finding an iota of defiance.
"The Federation offers the hand of peace, but do not think that we are weak.
It would be a grave mistake for you to make an enemy of Starfleet.
You're trying to intimidate me? Now?
Maddo shared a callous chuckle with his red bands.
Too late for that.
He's not making a threat, Wheaton blurted. He's stating a fact. You heard him before. We can help your people. Find you a world to colonize, a better one than some half-dead ball of rock. Why wouldn't you want that?
He gave Saru that questioning look again.
Why can't he trust us?
The answer is simple, said Maddo. The Gorlands have no more of that commodity to spare to outworlders. From now on, things will be on our terms.
Hand by hand, he pulled himself along a support pillar until he was floating in front of Saru and the ensign.
We will take back our people. And when the Shenzhou comes, we will take that as well.
The statement was so unexpected that Saru took a second to be sure of what he had heard.
Impossible.
With your ship and this one, we will be free to go wherever we want, and the Federation, the Pleiades, the Tholians, the Creator can damn them all.
Maddo's cold rage had crystallized into an iron-hard certainty.
That's not going to happen, retorted Wheaton. Captain Georgiou will never let you have her ship.
You will show us how to take it, said Maddo, staring at the Kelpian.
No, said Saru. His voice sounded small and weak.
If you do not do as I say, I will kill the prisoners. I will start with the Pleiar captain and your wounded engineer. Or perhaps this one.
He pointed in Wheaton's direction.
Do you see, Saru? Your only value is what you can do for me. Aid us, and you live. You have worth. Or do not, and become worthless. This is the reality we inhabit now.
He drew back and began making his way toward the hatch.
But one step at a time. Purge the computer. Begin the recovery process.
The other red bands drifted toward them, some drawing their weapons. Wheaton pulled close to Saru, and his eyes were wide.
Sir, we can't do this!
You can, Maddo called from the hatch. Tell him, Saru. You did it before. Once the line is crossed, once you have bowed the first time, it becomes easier to do it again.
He left them behind in the silence that followed.
What did he mean, before?
The question in Wheaton's expression shaded toward confusion, and then anger.
Lieutenant, is he talking about our ship? When they attacked them? Did you—
I am giving you a direct order, Ensign, Saru said in a toneless, dead voice. Full responsibility for whatever follows is mine and mine alone. Purge the control software from the Pleiar computer core. The shock on Wheaton's face was raw and bitter.
I won't collaborate with them, he began,
but Saru didn't let him finish.
Do it! He barked.
There was a long pause, and Saru was afraid that Wheaton would defy him again, and that would cost the ensign his life. But then the junior officer's face became a stony mask.
Lieutenant Burnham would never have done this.
I know, Saru sighed. Carry out my orders. The interlaced communications between the two escort drones flashed back and forth between them at speeds most organic brains would have been unable to follow. Second by second, the automated craft shared data on the most optimal targeting solutions to maintain on the Federation starship they were flanking, their phase cannon turrets constantly adjusting and readjusting to account for drift and course corrections. So far, the attack criteria they had been programmed with had not arisen. The target ship was following the determined course, its weapons were inactive, its deflector shields down. Constant sensor sweeps pulsing in tandem kept the Shenzhou firmly in their crosshairs.
The synthetic combat intelligences running each craft were ready to open fire if their target deviated from the predetermined behavior pattern. But the automated ships were only as good as their programmers could make them. Even with the advanced heuristic learning algorithms that Piliar Zell gave their autonomous machines, they lacked the ability of an organic being to anticipate, to become suspicious, or to make an intuitive leap based on partial data. Thus, when both drone brains detected the activation of the Shenzhou's matter transporter system, there was a pause as the craft collaborated over the problem of what to do about it. Their masters hadn't provided a specific retaliation program for such an occurrence. It would be up to the drones to decide how best to proceed. All of this transpired in a matter of heartbeats, and given the martial nature of their standing orders, it was no surprise that the drones decided in unison to default to their most basic command. If in doubt, attack. But the delay in processing that conclusion was a fraction longer than the Shenzhou's transporter cycle. Both drones registered two sets of rematerialization events in very close proximity to them and the immediate activation of electromagnetic clamps on their outer hulls. The unit following the Shenzhou from behind reacted by spinning its turret around so that the visual sensors mounted beneath its gun cluster could see what was now attached to the outside of its fuselage. The sensors fixated on two figures, each one clad in a protective EVA suit. The closer of the pair, a dark-skinned humanoid female whose face was visible through the transparent shell of a helmet, held a phaser rifle in her hands. The weapon was aimed directly at the turret. "Surprise," said Burnham, and she squeezed the trigger. The pulse bursts blasted through the swivel ring at the base of the phase cannon turret, and the whole upper section of the weapon array was blown free. Trailing bright orange sparks, the neutered guns drifted away in the Shenzhou's impulse wake. Burnham was aware of another phaser blast going off at the periphery of her vision, back where the second drone was ahead of the starship's bow, but she had no time to dwell on it. "Shanahan, go!" she called out to the engineer standing behind her, similarly affixed to the drone's hull via magnetic boots. The chief petty officer had a cutting torch ready to go, and she quickly set to burning through a panel in order to gain access to the vessel's interior. Puffs of ion thrust shot from ports on the side of the drone, and it started to move. Burnham looked for and found clusters of sensor antennae on the craft's bow and shot them off, blinding it. "We're in," said the engineer. She let the cutter drift free on the end of the lanyard, securing it to her arm, and crouched over the hole she had cut in the hull. "Okay, let me see." "No time," Burnham retorted. "We can't allow this thing to self-destruct." "I got it, Lieutenant. Forget the finesse." Shanahan's face screwed up with effort as she plunged both hands into the spaces where the drone's central processor was located and ripped out whatever she could grab hold of. Glowing cables came free in her hands, and a shudder ran down the length of the craft. The ion thrusters went dead, and Burnham felt the drone starting to drift. "I think that may have done it." "Let's not wait around to find out," said the engineer, grabbing the cutter once again. "Give me 2 minutes, and I'll have the access control chopped out of there." Burnham let out the breath she had been holding in. "Team 2, this is Team 1. She turned to look out toward the other drone. It was in a slow tumble, and she could make out 2 suited forms still attached to its hull. "Ensign Harewood, report."
"Target neutralized,"
came the reply. One of the figures threw a wave in her direction.
"We got it, Lieutenant. Chief Geimer's doing the extraction right now."
"All right." She allowed herself a smile of relief. "Shenzhou, did you copy that?"
"We did," said Captain Georgiou. "Good call, Michael. You've just solved both of our problems at once."
She started back toward the aft of the drone, her mag boots thudding as she walked. Ahead of her, Shanahan was slowly pulling a large cube-shaped module from the escort's warp nacelle.
"The Piliars won't agree."
Burnham didn't want to think that what she had set in motion could technically be considered an act of piracy.
"We don't answer to them," said Giorgio. "And if Starfleet Command has a problem with this, well, I'll burn that bridge when I come to it."
She became brisk and businesslike.
"All EVA teams, get what we need and beam back. We have a lot of lost time to make up."
10.
"Warp 1," said Detmer, as she slowly eased the Shenzhou's throttle control forward, increment by increment. 2. 3.
A worrying vibration rang through the length of the decking, and a low alarm chimed at the engineering station. Burnham looked toward Belin Oliveira, who stood at temporary duty before Britch Wheaton's usual post. The dark-haired junior lieutenant didn't look up, her attention buried in the display screen in front of her. She raised a hand and signaled with a half-hearted thumbs up.
"Proceed," ordered Commander Cethelo.
He stood at parade ground attention behind the helmsop console, looking out over Detmer's head at the coruscating colors of the distorted stars flashing past them.
"Warp factor 4.
Detmer pushed the throttle up one more detent, but the vibration didn't ease out.
"Warp 5.
The alarm at the engineering panel went up a pitch, and the shuddering in the deck matched it.
"Captain, I am getting a lot of red flags here," said Oliveira. "We're outside acceptable parameters. We can't maintain this speed for more than a few minutes."
Cethelo made a soft growling noise and turned back to the center seat.
"We knew this might happen. Pelear technology is close to Federation standard, but not close enough. If the Shenzhou were a newer ship, we might be able to better synchronize the Axis controls, but..."
"We'll make do," Giorgio broke in. "We may not have the clean lines of those new Constitution-class boats, but we're built tough."
The Andorian shrugged.
"To be honest, I don't really like that new minimalist look."
"Ensign Detmer," continued the captain, "ease us back to 3.5 and hold there. We're at warp, and that's better than where we were an hour ago."
Burnham glanced at data readouts on her screen at the science station, a telemetry feed from the warp core where one of the recovered Pelear Axis control units struggled to do the job of its Starfleet equivalent. It was a jury-rigged repair, what Chief Petty Officer Shanahan had called a bloody lash-up. But it was working.
"Hang on, Saru," she said silently. "We're on the way."
But that thought was immediately followed by the shadow of a doubt.
"Will we catch up to that ship before something worse happens?"
Burnham brought up a different display, this one a navigation plot from Troy Yanuzi's station. It showed Shenzhou following the decaying ion wake of the star freighter and the fresher trail left behind by Taw's carrier ship, twin arcs of faint color that curved around nearby nebulae and back toward what the Pelear Admiral had called the Sanctuary, a nondescript star system designated in the Galactic Catalog as DRL-559-G.
"At best speed, just under 2 days," said a quiet voice behind her.
Captain Giorgio looked over Burnham's shoulder at the star map.
"Not good enough." 47 hours, 17 minutes, Burnham said automatically, the calculation coming to her by reflex. "Avoiding that nebula formation virtually doubles our point-to-point transit time. It's laced with reactive Metreon gas pockets, so we can't walk through it. We take that route, and we're back to impulse power, no shields again,"
Giorgio said with a nod. "I've had enough of that for one day." Burnham turned as the first officer crossed over to her console. His antennae arched forward in the way they always did when he was frustrated over something.
"There's another option," he said in a low voice. "I am loath to even voice it, but I am this ship's executive officer, and it is my duty to point out alternatives."
Burnham suspected she knew what Cethelo was going to say, and she stepped back to allow him to use her console. He manipulated the star map, zooming out to show a larger slice of the local region. DRL-559-G,
The nebula and the Pleiades and Deimos systems appeared on the visual, along with a patch of space that was marked out in a stark crimson. The color designated a Starfleet-mandated danger zone, stellar hazards, or enemy territory.
"Beware the Jabberwock," she thought,
the line from the old poem coming to mind unbidden.
"There is a course that will get us there a lot faster," Chithalo said as he plotted a new path. "And in my opinion, it is an extremely bad idea."
The adjusted course projection took a different heading, away from the route around the nebula and directly over the red line, cutting across the corner of the danger zone, into space formerly annexed and controlled by the forces of the Tholian Assembly.
"We'd be inside the Tholian borders for around 10 hours, he went on.
9 hours, 31 minutes, said Burnham.
"As I said, an extremely bad idea."
"That could stir up the hornet's nest," admitted Giorgio. "It's fairly certain they've been keeping tabs on us. We know for sure they blasted our monitor buoy. If we cross into their space, we're giving them what they want," finished Burnham. "But if we don't, and we arrive too late for Saru and the others..." She trailed off.
"Have we detected any activity on the Tholian side of the border?" said Giorgio.
"Negative," noted the first officer. "In fact, it's been unusually quiet over there. Odd, considering recent events. If I had to hazard a guess, I would reason their ships are elsewhere. Either that, or deliberately lying dormant."
"I know what Starfleet Command would say," said the captain. "Do you think we need their guidance, Number One?" A wry smile pulled at the corner of Chithalo's mouth.
"We haven't up until now."
Giorgio nodded to herself.
"Roll the dice, Commander. With any luck, the irregular warp field emissions we're putting out with that replacement access unit will confuse the hell out of them."
"Captain," Burnham reached out to Giorgio before she could move away. "There's something I have to ask you."
Giorgio exchanged a look with the first officer.
"Go on."
"I believe we should transmit an encrypted subspace message to the Yang. Our people need to know that Admiral Taw is on his way."
Her tone rose, becoming insistent.
"You heard what he said. He doesn't want to end this situation peacefully. If we can warn Saru and the others, it might give them an advantage. If we don't, they'll be looking the other way when Taw's ship arrives with a squadron of attack drones."
"You were paying attention," Chithalo said firmly, "to the parts of the conversation we just had about Tholians and nests of deadly stinging insects, yes?"
"Yes, sir, but—"
He spoke over her in a low hiss that didn't travel.
"To get through this, we need to keep our emissions as low as possible, Lieutenant. Avoid detection. Sending out a subspace signal would be the very opposite of that."
Chithalo's antennae stiffened.
"We don't even know if any of our people are still alive to hear it."
"Then why are we going after them?"
Burnham matched his tone.
"Just to pick up the bodies of our dead? Taw already promised to do that for us."
"Commander? Lieutenant?" Giorgio raised a hand to end the discussion. "We're doing this thing, and I say we go all in." She gave Burnham a nod.
"Send the message, Michael. Work with Ensign Fan to mask the signal as much as possible."
"I don't like it," said Chithalo.
"You don't like anything, Sonny,"
the captain told him, patting the Andorian on the shoulder.
"That's your job."
Saru sat alone in the familiar silence of the shuttle's cockpit and stared mournfully through the canopy. Out past the Yang's nose and the acres of curved hull metal it rested upon, he had a view that extended away toward the distant aft impulse drive cluster, which formed the end of the star freighter's spine. Large, dark shapes cluttered the space around the flanks of the vessel, each one the asymmetrical, wedge-like form of a massive cargo module. As the Kelpian watched, he saw flashes of ion fire flare at the corners of some units, nudging them closer to the transport ship. In turn, Fans of glittering blue-green light spread from heavy-duty tractor beam emitters along the length of the vessel, capturing the modules and maneuvering them into position. The containers were stacking atop ones already in place, locking them together to form one single structure. Over the past few hours, the mass of the Pelear ship had almost doubled with all the new additions. He watched the silent motion and wondered about the beings inside the containers. The Yang's sensors were reading a massive density of Gorlan life readings within them as the entire surviving population of their colony packed themselves into the last few functioning modules and evacuated their temporary home. Saru had listened in on the messages Vetch had sent to the Gorlans on the surface. Even across the distance, he had sensed the powerful mix of raw anger, desperation, and elation at the possibility of a second chance. The refugees down on the sanctuary planet had been lost without their hub to guide them, and to know she was still alive gave them renewed hope. But that would soon fade, he realized, and the Gorlans would turn to resentment for what they had been put through. "They are a proud and passionate people," he thought. "I don't know if Ija's guidance will be enough to temper their fury." Saru wanted to speak with her again, to implore her to turn Mado away from his plan to mount another attack on the Shenzhou, but the red bands had made it very clear to the Kelpian that would not be permitted. He had no way to know if Ija was even aware of what her guardians were considering. He imagined not. Mado and Vetch had both spoken of deeds they had done without her knowledge, of acts that were necessary to keep her safe. In their own way, they were protecting her, shielding the hub from the darker truths of their survival. He considered trying to find a way back down into the cargo compartments, but the red bands were watching him closely at all times. Even now, one of them was nearby in the corridor below the hatch connecting to the shuttlecraft. Saru had told the Gorlan he needed to prepare a data card using the Yang's small mainframe that would complete the work of deleting the control software from the freighter's subsystems, but that was a partial truth. He could have finished the work up on the transport's command deck or by using his tricorder. The real reason he had come back to the shuttle was to find some brief isolation. Saru was worn down by the certainty that everyone around him was judging his behavior. Ensign Wheaton made no secret of his aversion to Saru's orders, and the junior officer had practically called him a coward to his face. Despite their own shock at learning the truth about the sanctuary planet, he suspected Nathal and Hekan saw Saru as a Gorlan collaborator, and the Gorlans themselves thought him to be weak. "How did this go so wrong?" he wondered aloud, peering morosely at the control console as the data card completed its upload. "My intentions were good. How have I ended up here?" Down below, the red band, who had been shadowing him, banged a cudgel on the bottom of the hatch.
"Outworlder, how much longer is this going to take?"
"It will be a while," he lied. On a bleak impulse, Saru let his hands drop onto the shuttle's flight control yoke. He briefly considered closing the hatch and firing up the thrusters, tearing the Yang away and escaping. "Run, Saru." A voice in the back of his mind, a memory from his deep past, clawed its way up to the surface of his thoughts. "Run, Saru," it said. "Run and don't look back."
"No!"
He bit out the word. The frightened, untested youth he had once been was long gone. It was one thing to embrace caution, but he was not a coward. He wanted to get up out of the chair and march back down there, demand Mado's attention and another audience with the hub, the consequences be damned. But his self-doubt was corrosive, and with every moment he hesitated, the fear and anxiety second-guessed each thought that passed through his mind. It was like a horrible kind of paralysis, and if only he could see a way past it, he might overcome it. A beeping tone sounded from the Yang's subspace communicator grid, and it came as such a surprise that it shocked Saru rigid. In the next second, he shook off the reaction and snatched up a wireless receiver, pressing it to his ear. The communicator's system asked for a personal security code to decrypt the incoming message. His eyes widened as he saw the origin of the narrowband signal. USS Shenzhou, NCC 1227. "Authorization, Kappa Saru 7," he whispered, throwing a worried look back at the open hatch in the compartment behind him. If the Gorlan came up to see what was taking so long, if Saru was caught, it would not go well for the Kelpian. A loud buzzing crackle sounded in Saru's aural canal, and he winced at the noise. The communication had all the characteristics of a burst transmission message, sent at high gain in the hopes that it would be picked out of the void by the Yang's monitoring systems. As the shuttle's decryption subroutines rearranged the coded signal back into something discernible, Saru listened with increasing concern as the garbled sounds merged together into a familiar voice. "This is Lieutenant Burnham aboard the Shenzhou. To anyone aboard the shuttle Yang, this is a Priority One message. We've repaired the damage inflicted on our ship and are currently tracking the fugitive transport. Be advised, a drone carrier warship from the Pilyar Zell system is ahead of us and will arrive at your location before we can reach you. This vessel's intentions are aggressive. Repeat, aggressive." Burnham paused, and Saru could hear the dread in her voice. "Do whatever you can to protect yourselves. We're on our way, but it may be a while. We're taking a shortcut. Until then, hold fast. Shenzhou out." A torrent of reactions swept through Saru, and he had to steel himself to rein them all in. Relief that Burnham, and hopefully everyone else aboard the Shenzhou, was unhurt. Hope that they would arrive in time to stop things from getting any worse. Trepidation over this new reveal of the approaching warship, and finally dismay at the reckoning that would come from the choices he had been forced to make. It took a physical effort on his part to take all of those conflicting emotions and push them down, seal them away. "I should have paid more attention to Burnham when she talked about those Vulcan meditation rituals of hers." He sighed, drawing a deep breath, and then played back the message once again to make certain he had missed nothing. Saru heard the clanking of heavy footfalls on the ladder frame beneath the hatch, and then the red band's head and shoulders appeared through the open panel. He looked around suspiciously, finally finding Saru up at the shuttle's bow.
"You have been in here for too long. What are you doing?"
The Gorlan hauled himself the rest of the way inside and immediately swatted the open door of an armory locker on the wall where the Yang's small store of phasers was kept. All of the firearms had already been looted by Maddo and his comrades, but the red band was clearly wondering if they might have missed some. Saru deftly pocketed the wireless receiver before the Gorlan saw it and deactivated the communications grid. "I am finished."
"Then get moving," snapped the Gorlan.
"Of course." Saru climbed out of the pilot's chair and stepped around the red band. He considered his options. If he brought what he now knew to Maddo, if he forewarned him about the approaching Pilyar warship, it might be enough to convince the militant leader to let him talk with Ija. "That would mean surrendering the only advantage I have," Saru considered. "And to what gain? The hope that Maddo will show me trust?" He frowned. "No. I must approach this in a different way. But before I can do that, I must take ownership of the mistakes that I have made." "You," he said, drawing himself up to his full height, "you will take me back to the rest of the captives."
"No, Maddo said you need to complete your tasks for us, and then—"
"I need the rest of my team to complete the tasks," he shot back. "Do you want to be the one to tell Maddo that you stopped me from finishing what I started?" The red band scowled and kneaded the grip of the cudgel in one of his hands, enough that Saru thought he might strike him for daring to show defiance. But then the Gorlan gave a rough shrug and waved him away.
Go on, then, and do not waste any more time.
I don't intend to, Saru replied, dropping back through the open airlock hatch.
He's still the senior officer, said Yashe, blinking her large eyes.
She looked up and met Wheaton's gaze as he sat across from her on the other side of the table, bolted to the mess hall floor.
We can't just ignore his orders.
Who said anything about ignore? Wheaton replied. I'm talking about someone countermanding him.
The ensign nodded toward the next table along, where Saladin Johar lay unconscious beneath a silvery survival blanket.
Saru is making one bad choice after another, and it can't go on.
We're not waking, Johar, said Zoxum, and the words were stone hard. I mean it. I don't care whose rank says what. You can write me up or whatever. The chief engineer is not well enough. I can't be sure what the shock to his system would do.
No one is saying we need to do that, Wheaton backtracked. I'm just saying that Lieutenant Saru isn't who we need in charge right now.
His argument picked up momentum as he went on.
I like the guy, kinda, I do. But he bends like the willow, and we need an oak right now, you know what I mean?
I don't, sir. Subin ran a hand over her brow. What are willow and oak?
They're both kinds of Terran animals, said Yashe.
They're trees, Wheaton corrected with an exasperated snort. Okay, listen, forget the analogies. I'll stick to facts. Saru is all about playing it safe, right? And so every time something has happened here, he's chosen not to put up a fight. So where does that leave us? As hostages, like them?
He jerked a thumb at the group of captive Paliars keeping to themselves on the far side of the compartment.
No, worse than that. We're collaborating with terrorists. We've helped Maddo take full control of this ship from its rightful owners. And now he's demanding we help him take our ship next. How the hell does that square up to the chain of command?
Yashe stared at the deck.
So what are you driving at, Ensign? Because this sounds a lot like mutiny talking.
Don't be ridiculous, Chief, Wheaton replied. We're not using the M-word, but there's precedent for overruling an officer if he continually makes questionable decisions.
He looked at Zoxum.
Fitness for command and that kind of thing, right?
I don't know if I could go along with that, said the nurse.
Why not?
Subin glanced across at the broad-shouldered Zano.
The ensign's not wrong.
Because we don't know what Lieutenant Saru is thinking, and we don't get to second-guess our officers, Zoxum said firmly.
Then maybe we need to know what he's thinking, said Yashe,
looking up as the mess hall's doorway clanked open.
So let's ask him.
Wheaton turned with the rest of them as Saru entered, and the Kelpian stiffened as he realized that he had been the subject of their now silenced conversation.
Lieutenant, said Yashe as he approached. Sir, we've been talking...
I do not doubt it, Saru replied, and he glanced in Wheaton's direction, then away again. What is Mr. Johar's condition?
Stable, said Zoxum. But I honestly don't know how long he'll stay that way. He needs proper medical attention and a full surgical suite. The sick bay on this tub isn't good enough. It's just a bunch of autodoc robots, and they're only programmed with Paliar anatomy.
I know you're doing your best, nurse. Saru's head bobbed in a nodding motion, and he halted in front of the group, scanning their weary expressions. At length, he sat down on the bench so he could address them all.
Where are the Gorlan guards?
Subin glanced over his shoulder.
Moving back to the hatch, sir. Out of earshot, I'd say.
Good. He let out a sigh.
None of this is going the way we expected it to.
I came back to this ship because I hoped I could help these people, but instead I dragged all of us into... this.
No one...
Wheaton started to speak, then paused, trying to frame his words correctly.
It's not your fault, Lieutenant. You're just not the...
He faltered again.
I mean,
I'm not up to it? Saru met his gaze. The Kelpian, who runs and hides every time someone drops a hyperspanner? I know what is said about me, Ensign. I am not deaf.
Are you up to it? Subin said softly. Because I will follow your orders, sir. But I need to know. We all need to know.
Yes, he agreed.
You do.
In my officer training classes at Starfleet Academy, they told me that in order for a commander to lead, they must have the trust of their subordinates. Speaking in hushed tones that would not carry beyond the group, Saru leaned close, offering Subin, Wheaton, and the others the only thing he could. His honesty. I don't have yours. And the fault is mine alone. None of them disagreed, and the silence was damning. Saru went on. I have acted rashly and without full consideration of my actions. I wasn't supposed to come back to this ship. I was expected to remain on board the Shenzhou. But I did so anyway, because I thought I knew better. Wheaton and Zoxum exchanged glances.
The Exo said as much, noted the ensign. He told Johar to go haul you back.
Saru nodded. That man is badly wounded because of the choices I made. He took a disruptor blast meant for me. And if I dwell on that guilt for more than an instant, I fear it will become crippling. He shook off the thought. The only way I know how to engender your trust is to be truthful. This is my truth. He looked to Subin. I came back to this ship because I thought I could do something against my nature. Take a blind risk in the name of achieving something greater. Saru recalled that conversation in the Shenzhou's shuttle bay when he spoke to Burnham of rules and regulations. I tried to emulate someone else, to be a person I am not, and it was a mistake. His gaze shifted to Zoxum. Then we were here, and things started to fall apart. I told myself I could hold things together if only I could find a way to prevent any more loss of life. So I made another choice, a compromise. I aided an aggressor in an attack against our own ship.
You told Mado where to hit the Shenzhou, said the nurse. The engines, not the crew decks.
Saru nodded again. It was logical.
I can't believe you did that!
Wheaton's face hardened.
You should have refused, point blank!
And then what?
Zoxum looked to the ensign.
Mado would have put a salvo into our ship anyway, killed who knows how many.
The captain would have fired back.
If she was still alive,
the nurse countered.
And how many dead would there have been?
He shook his head.
It was an impossible decision to make. It was triage.
I did what I thought would save lives, said Saru, silencing them both. And then again when Mado threatened to kill Hekan. And again when he promised he would execute Johar and Nathal if I did not assist him.
And what about now, sir?
Yushe said, her voice catching.
Are we really going to help these hijackers take control of the Shenzhou as well? Mado thinks if he pulls a gun, you'll buckle. Are you going to keep on making compromises? Where do we draw the line?
Saru marshaled his thoughts.
This is my only chance to make them comprehend, he told himself. If I can't convince them to stand with me, then my rank and commission mean nothing.
He looked down and glumly realized that his rank insignia was already gone, already sacrificed elsewhere for the vain hope of a peaceful resolution. On my homeworld, our lives were an endless cycle of fear. We could never stand our ground because the odds were always against us. Then things changed, and I left my world behind. I became part of this. He pulled at the blue metallic material of his uniform. And I learned that there are always predators, and that they wear many skins. But I also learned what Mado and Nathal and the angry, bitter people on both sides of this conflict have not. He looked toward Ensign Wheaton. Compassion is not weakness. Enduring is not living. And belligerence is not strength. The phantom weight that had been bearing down on Saru seemed to lessen and fade.